Today is Thursday. It's February 25th, 2021. It's 1:38 in the afternoon. And hi again, this is Sean Williams. You're listening to The Mincing Rascals, the weekly podcast we record throughout Chicagoland via Zoom. You can listen to me weekdays on WGN Radio from 9 to noon.
I'm Austin Burke from the Illinois Policy Institute.
I'm Lisa Donovan. I write the Spin Politics newsletter for the Chicago Tribune.
And I'm Eric Zwan, the unquestionable columnist for the Chicago Tribune.
Do you guys always get what he's talking about when he does that, unquestionable?
That one I didn't get.
No. Lise, do you know what he's talking about?
No, I largely don't.
As a rule, you don't.
The allusion is to Ed Kodat, the young man who was appointed to the House by Speaker Madigan, former Speaker Madigan, and then they had to let him go for questionable content.
Well, let's start with that. So former Speaker Mike Madigan resigned his seat. He appointed a little-known ward worker named Edward Guerra Kodat. Nothing seems special or problematic about his qualifications, except that his answers to questions were really vague, and he seemed very green. Asked to name his favorite governor, he said he didn't have one. The perfect, by the way, but missed follow-up question of that would have been, name one. But he didn't even seem to be very aware of the police reform bill. And that's very near and dear to the constituents in his new district. Anyway, after 2 days, something dark in his past surface, we don't know what, and he resigned after 48 hours. The new representative is Angelica Guerra Cuellar. Am I getting that right or close? C-U-E-L-L-A-R. So,
Cuellar.
Angelica Guerra Cuellar.
I think it's Angelica Guerra Cuellar.
What did I say?
I think you pronounce the L's. I don't think those are silent.
Cuellar. Well, that just goes to show you how much these people ain't Mike Madigan. By the way, we're going to pay for 3 full months of salary for each of them for the month of February, which, frankly, I don't mind. That seems to be a big talking point in town today. I just want to know what happened. How is it that we don't know what happened and what happened? You guys are pretty dialed in. Lisa?
No, the only rumors and innuendo, nothing specific, nothing where I can say I can't share. Nobody seems to know. There's a zero tolerance policy, and that's somehow linked to the job.
I heard he was moonlighting as a property tax appeals attorney, and people figured that out, and that was a big no-no.
No, that's everybody else. Eric, have you heard?
No, I haven't heard. I would have to assume, I mean, that it has something to do with Me Too. I would guess that they would have looked for a criminal thing in his past. I mean, that certainly some due diligence must have been done before they appointed him, although clearly not much. I mean, this guy sort of came out of nowhere, and I guess people liked the cut of his jib or something. And then as soon as it came out, it didn't take him very long at all to start talking about this, like I said, questionable conduct. So you have to assume that it is something of a private nature and something, and the speed at which they reacted, it seemed to me like it almost had to be a replay of some other scandal that had come close to Madigan, and that would have been the Me Too stuff from a couple of years ago. So that's just my guess, and we may never find out. It may be part of the arrangement they have with him is that, look, because it was odd to me that he just resigned, that he didn't put up any kind of fight at all. He didn't say, hey, no, I'm going to pull a Roland Burris here, and I'm going to stay.
Well, I mean, a lot of times it is quiet, and then suddenly they pop up somewhere else. I mean, not to say, I mean, but you will see this from time to time. I covered county government long enough to know, and some city government to know that bide your time for 6 months, then all of a sudden, oh, why are they now suddenly at the county? Or, oh, why are they suddenly, you know, a staffer at City Halls?
Well, aside from my own purient interest, like I want the goods, I also think I have a right to know. I mean, in fact, shouldn't we know?
Yeah, he's an elected official at that point. He's being asked to resign. That crossed my mind, too.
And they should ask that of all of the committee people who were in the room. And they should be asking it of Madigan and asking it of any party leadership that comes around after Madigan steps down. But I totally agree.
At least Madigan was asked that question this morning, or here Thursday morning, just that when they appointed now State Rep Cuellar. I think they went through the list of questions. Was it something work related? Did he misstate something during the Sunday vetting, when they were doing the appointment process then, and the committee persons were questioning him then? But I think you made the point, John, at the very beginning here. He did not get into any kind of specifics, so I don't know what he would have stated that mm-hmm. you know, might have been inaccurate.
Isn't it strange that Madigan, over all these years in the legislature, has developed this reputation for precision and care and meticulousness, and that at the end of his career here, he makes what looks to me to be a very careless and hasty and strange maneuver in appointing this young man who has some questionable conduct in his background, and then so quickly to appoint this woman. And I think we should just start calling her AGC, since we're not sure how to pronounce her. And the description of her is in the paper was that she has volunteered at several community agencies that provide services to people in the county without legal permission, or in the country without legal permission, and is married to a Chicago police officer. I mean, I don't know, maybe she might be a totally fine person. I don't know, that would be
a decent platform upon which you could run, but it doesn't make her stand out, does it?
Well, I don't know. It's just, and given the haste with which all this was done and the carelessness with which it was done the first time, it was just baffling to me. You would have thought that Madigan would have gamed. Everyone always talked about, oh, he plays three-dimensional chess. And so you're thinking that there's something going on here that he figured that in his position, he must have thought about this for months. Who's going to take my spot if I have to resign?
But he didn't pick her. Let's be clear here. He did in the end, but this was a candidate from Alderman Silvana Tabares, right? In that legislative district. She has a vote. She nominated her. And the new state rep came in, you know, on Sunday she had come in second place. And so how this all unfolded was that once they asked now former state rep Kodat to step down, Madigan came out and said, I will honor this by, you know, allowing the second place finisher to step into the job. Yes, he had the controlling vote, but he did not nominate her. That was not his first choice.
But it was his votes that elected her, right? And he had 56% of the vote. So
right, absolutely. But I mean, it wasn't. He didn't pick her outright. It was Silvana Tabares who lined up sort of that first round, and he wanted the Madigan wanted a unanimous vote on Sunday. There is a point at which, you know, they all sort of cast their votes for the, I think, two or three candidates received votes from the five committee members. And Madigan had asked, I think it's some kind of a, I don't know, just a sort of a show of sort of a unit of unity or something, but shall we make this a unanimous vote? And she and Alderman Tabara said, no, I'll let my vote stand.
So I thought I was clever, Lisa. So we called her on the show today, and she was happy to come on. Very nice lady. We had a nice conversation, Silvana Tabara and I. And I said, so maybe you know, right? I mean, you seem to be a player in this. He wasn't your guy. Guerra wasn't. The woman that you wanted for that position is in. Did you tip the dominoes on this? She said, no. I said, do you know who did? She said, no. I just said, do you know the nature of the dominoes? No. I said, how do you not know? I mean, we don't even know who said whatever it is that we don't know they said. I mean, it's amazing to me in this town with all of the political points to score that nobody is cashing in on that right now.
I mean, it's tribal, isn't it? I mean, she did not go with sort of the Madigan person, so they may not be sharing information with her. You know, I don't know that I have any necessarily, you know, reason to doubt.
Oh, no, I believed her. I was just a little baffled by it. And I am sort of apples and oranges here, right, in that she's in the city council and Madigan was in the state legislature. So those are different bodies. But it's the same area. And obviously they've intersected here. So how is it that she doesn't have any clue?
It may be a legal thing where, okay, I'm not going there. These are all allegations, right? The press release from Madigan was very, you know, upon learning of some allegation, it was suggested that Representative Kodat resign. That was what came out Tuesday night.
Well, and as I was suggesting, maybe they made some sort of deal with Kodat that, look, we are going to do all we can to put a lid on this questionable conduct of yours if you resign quickly. Otherwise, he could have stayed on. There was nothing that forced him to resign that we know of other than pressure. I'm wondering why Madigan and all those around him didn't say this was the moment to step back and say, wait a second, we went too quickly last time. We got in, we appointed somebody we didn't really know that well. let's take a deep breath, maybe take a week or two, and we'll think about this decision. They took a lot longer when they selected the replacement up north for Heather Staines. There was a much longer process, much more deliberative process. It was still an insider deal in the end, but at least you have the feeling that they actually did their due diligence here. I mean, I have no idea who AGC is. I don't know if she's going to prove to be have skeletons in her closet. Who knows? It's baffling to me, and especially given Madigan's reputation for deliberation.
Yeah, Eric's point to me seems to be sort of like the speed at which this was done is only advantageous to people with the most inside knowledge and the most existing power.
I write about this today in the newsletter. State government and state bureaucracy can move fast when they want to. They are able to pick two successors in 1 week. They're able to kind of gather and do that. And they already have up on the state General Assembly website that Kodat is a former state rep, and this new person who was just appointed 3 hours ago, she's already up there as the new state rep.
I mean, and meanwhile, there's half a million people waiting for unemployment benefits.
Yeah. Oh my God. Or that IDES would be so quick. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, they temporarily locked some unemployed residents out today, so the benefits are delayed. So yes,
the appointment process in general, I think, is only like there's never a serious conversation among folks about what a decent special election regime would look like, so that you don't constantly have these. I think there's like a, it doesn't have to be every time. It could be within some time window.
Yeah.
But the fact that this is 100% of the time, this is how it works. I don't know anyone who thinks that's a good way to pick your representatives, except people in office. And it's ridiculous that it hasn't changed.
Madigan had a very bad month. Let's put it that way.
The worst ever.
I talked to a couple of election experts about this, and indeed you're right, Austin, they did say this is not the way to do it. This appointment process, it just adds to the skepticism, particularly in Illinois politics, that everything is an insider job. So it does go to your point, Eric, too, that sort of like it just looks bad. But what one Kent Redfield at the University of Illinois, what he said would be ideal is to not have a special election, but to actually sort of, he said, to actually figure out a way that you could quickly tie it to the next regularly scheduled election. So the suburbs have a general election, I think, in April. They had their primary yesterday, and now the general election. He said there's a way.
Slotted in there.
Yes,
people are already going to vote.
And even if they're not, they'll be somewhat aware that, okay, you need to get out there and do it. And it also means that these candidates have to get out there and you know, hit the doors and figure out a way to make their case to people.
Well, when will she have to run?
It happen quickly, because there's a constitutional requirement. You can't disenfranchise people either. Like, you can't have that seat open so long that people don't have a representative in May when they decide the budget in particular. I don't know who would sue over that, because a lot of times when I talk to people, they don't know who their state legislators are. But
yeah, no kidding.
Nonetheless, you want somebody in there. They do constituent services, and you want people in there.
Well, we've spent enough time on this topic, and I'm glad that we did. Not so much because Guerrero is so important, but because of all of the machinations behind it and around it, and what does that mean? I'm actually willing to be underwhelmed when we find out what it is. Like, maybe it's something trivial and embarrassing, but it's no great crime against the state or humanity, or maybe it is. You know, I almost want to give this poor kid the benefit of the doubt. He seems whiplashed when you saw him last week, not even before this stuff hit the fan. And he must be sitting there. He's kind of in hiding right now, going, oh, geez, what happened? He's going to take his $5,000 and he doesn't have a job, because the job for which he left to take Madigan's seat is not waiting for him, and it doesn't sound like they want him back.
Comptroller Mendoza says she doesn't want to give him his money, or says he should not give it to him. But he said,
well, if she knows, and I saw that, Eric, and so if she knows what he did is so bad that he doesn't get the money that by law he should get, it's a screwy law, then she should tell us what it is. Why is she denying this kid his lawfully gained money? He's playing by the rules everybody else is.
I was trying to decide whether she knew or if she was just sort of saying, as the person who holds the state's purse, was asking him to maybe sort of do the ethical thing. Look, dude, you only worked 3 days and you're going to get paid for the whole month. That's not right. I just wasn't clear on that, but maybe you guys read.
No, that's a good point, Lisa. I think that would be another fair interpretation of it. Another way to manage this is that AGC going in agrees not to take pay until March 1st, so at least the taxpayers don't get triple dipped for Madigan, Cuellar, and Kodat. Yeah, a banner year for corruption in Illinois is how Dick Simpson from the University of Illinois Chicago described Illinois and Chicago in this latest report, right? We have been judged to be America's most corrupt city and the state the third most corrupt.
Doesn't surprise me. I mean, I've worked closely with Dick in the past on corruption stuff. Professor Simpson, he's an incredible resource. He was actually an alderman in 1970. That guy knows more about Chicago and Illinois politics than probably anybody. And they put out this report every year, which is invaluable. What surprises me, or what saddens me, is the extent to which this has just become an accepted norm in Illinois politics. The governor didn't campaign on being anti-corruption. Our attorney general didn't campaign on being anti-corruption. There's been no significant ethics reform passed. We may see some in this session. And even Mayor Lori Lightfoot, who campaigned on an anti-corruption platform, has been really ineffectual on this issue in particular. And that saddens me a great deal. One bright spot, and we looked at this when we were doing corruption analysis for the book on Chicago, The New Chicago Way, was if you adjust for population, Chicago over the last 10 years or so is not the most corrupt big city.
Hooray.
In the country.
Well, look at that.
Our northern district. Yeah. So, like,
what are we, number two?
And yeah, we're like middle of the pack for big cities. And it's because we have a really robust inspector general at the city level. And the problem is there's no such office at the state level, and they should make one.
I have a broader question about this, and I totally acknowledge we have a lot of corruption here, but is part of it the fact that we have had fairly aggressive U.S. attorneys investigating corruption here, and there's a media focus on it? And I bring this up because we had this situation come up with some of the death penalty stuff 2 decades ago or so, which is that we kept finding these cases of wrongful convictions and people on death row, and the same thing is Illinois uniquely terrible. And the question sort of became, well, this sort of a chicken and egg question. Is it uniquely terrible, or is it because we have this community of journalists and law professors and other advocates who are looking for these things and investigating these cases, whereas in other states they don't have them? So I would put this question to Austin. I'm just wondering, is it possible that one of the reasons that we find that there is so much corruption found here is that we're looking for it harder than they're looking for it in Kentucky or Georgia?
No, it's a really good question. And we considered that when we're looking at Chicago corruption. You have to account, it's very difficult to account for the aggression of the federal office. Like, you can't like control for that factor really across states in any, you know, material way. But the fact is, still, there's been more than one public corruption conviction per week in Illinois since 1983. It's a problem. It's a big problem. And the fact is, and so say if a politician were to make that argument, right, that, hey, federal prosecutors are really, really aggressive here, the logical next step would be to say, well, like, get your own house in order, pass some state laws that don't allow this kind of behavior to go on all the time. And for the people of Illinois to have to rely on, you know, the president of the United States to keep John Lausch here or something like that, like put systems in place that other states have, like a robust inspector general or like conflict of interest laws, revolving door laws, and you can make a dent. Don't wait on the feds.
Speaking of the inspector general, how did you all read the inspector general's report on how the city handled the violence in the spring? We talked to the deputy inspector general on our show. I presume you all are pretty dialed in on that.
Well, the report seemed very thorough. And actually, I did not read the report itself. I just read all the stories about the report. And it seemed to me that Superintendent Brown, who was really new on the job, I think it was like he'd been there, 6 weeks, as anyone remember? Not very long at all when all this broke out. Just was not ready for it. The department itself wasn't ready for it. That they made some assumptions based on how we handled the NATO 7 or the G7 meeting here, and the fact that the protests over Laquan McDonald never really went sideways. And they just said, oh, well, you know, this happens elsewhere, but it doesn't really happen here. That they were just, you know, a failure to anticipate, and then during the crisis itself, it seemed like it was just a lot of strange moving the pieces around the board that didn't make a lot of sense. So it was really a failure from the top down. I don't know how much the mayor could have done about it, but certainly at the command level in the police department, it looked like they didn't do very well. Now, Lightfoot came back and said, well, this was unprecedented and our police officers were under a lot of stress and were being attacked in ways that they hadn't been attacked before and so on. And I certainly understand that as well. But it certainly to me looked like a call for some real second guessing now within the department about what are we going to do if and when this happens this summer.
I was reminded of how disorganized the plan was, or the fact that there wasn't a plan. You know, there'd be several cops in one area not knowing where to go or how to get where they needed to be. And other places where we did need police, there weren't enough of them. And even if they were there, they couldn't chase everybody running in and out of a store on foot. They just literally didn't have the means to handle the situation. It was a lack of preparation from the get-go. The report didn't say how we're going to fix it. And it wasn't as specific, as I understand it, as maybe some of us wanted it to be, at naming names and placing the blame. Like, who needs to take the fall for this?
Your interview, I thought, was really good, John. But you could tell that the deputy IG was not about to, you know, start pointing fingers at folks. She was very judicious
in the way
she talked about
things. I laughed at her a couple of times, and I didn't mean to cause offense. But, she was so careful. I thought, lady, how do we know? You're the one that knows. Tell us. Tell us what you know. Tell us what you think. Well, that's not our position. I said, well, it's not my position either. I just didn't spend 7 months working on it. So what do you know? She knew her responsibilities and did not get outside her box.
I thought the report, there was so much material in the report, and it was so damning. And I think, especially for the mayor to get a black eye from a place like the Washington Post, when normally when Mayor Lightfoot is getting glowing national media coverage, is, and especially on an issue like this, had to have stung a lot. And Eric was right when he said, you know, the constant theme throughout the report was confusion and chaos. There was no plan to address civil unrest in Chicago, which is crazy. Like, we're the third largest city. There's no comprehensive plan to address when people get really angry and want to protest or even riot. And in place of that, we were left with kind of the mayor and the police chief improvising this patchwork response that left everybody really confused. It left protesters vulnerable to wrongful arrest. And it left ultimately like businesses burning. There were serious consequences to not having a plan. And that message was loud and clear, I thought, in the report.
The point was, you guys were disorganized. The top cop, the police superintendent, yeah, he was a month on the job, but you have to assess these situations. The job of the police is to respond to sort of these big emergencies, and you don't really get sort of a grace period through there. They said that he continued to downplay it. So it raises the concern about whether he knows what he's doing. He comes with stellar credentials. I'm not saying that, but it does leave the question. As somebody who lives in the city, the report scared me, frankly. I thought it was frightening. As a journalist, it scared me because at any point, you know, we are all called out to sort of to report on this. I don't do that as much now, but we could all be out there in the middle of this stuff. And if it makes you think, okay, this was dangerous, and my colleagues were out there and we knew it was dangerous. People were getting things stolen, shoved around, injured. It just didn't seem like anybody knew what they were doing. I think there's a lot of ripples to all of that. I think it plants a seed maybe with some in the business community about like, okay, do we want to be operating here? It really, really stung.
And then on Monday, J.B. Pritzker signs that bill, which to a lot of police officers ties their hands even further. It's a very volatile topic on my radio show, probably throughout town. Some people think this was much overdue. And other people think, well, we're just making it harder for these guys and gals to do their jobs.
Well, you know, the main thing that seemed to come up a lot in the bill was a discussion we've had on this podcast before, which has to do with the elimination, the gradual elimination of cash bail, and whether that's going to make streets any safer when you are allowing people who are arrested on serious crimes to get out of jail without posting bond. And if, you know, what we've said here already is that, you know, judges are going to have to step in and make determinations about whether people are dangerous. Too often you do see crime reports of, you know, so-and-so is arrested for a weapons charge or an assault charge, murder charge, and he was out on bond. Or a judge had released him on his own recognizance or something like that. That kind of stuff does happen. So that was the big issue that seemed to be percolating. It seems like a lot of these other things, like the mandate for body cameras that's going to go into effect, those sorts of regulations are things that do make sense.
Attorney General Raul made a comment to the effect of, unintended consequences and, you know, things that need to be cleaned up, you know, we'll do that later. And I think a lot of people seized on that as kind of admitting there are flaws in this and there's consequences when you pass something with such little oversight in the last four. I know it's been debated for years previously, but the legislative process was so quick. Lawmakers did not have time to read it. And it was kind of confirming a lot of people's suspicions that there's a lot of parts of this that are really messy, and that's not a good way to pass legislation when you're saying, oh, we'll fix, you know, all the problems with it later.
What about the Chicago Public Schools and the Chicago Teachers Union? CTU said they don't want to go back until they get access to the vaccines. The CPS, the schools, then said, okay, we'll reserve the right to not let teachers back in unless they agree to get a vaccine. I'm like, well, what does the teachers union want? Do they want the vaccines or not? They also want the right, though, to not have to take the vaccine. The union is at least dismayed that they weren't brought into the discussion about that decision more.
The CTU was dismayed about something that CPS did. So, yeah, I mean, So my fiance is actually getting her second round of her vaccine pretty soon, I think in a week.
Yeah.
And she's a teacher up at Skokie. And it seems like a lot of these local school districts, even in the suburbs, have fully vaccinated some of their teachers, which is surprising and has not gotten a lot of coverage. It's gotten a little bit, but it is really interesting that there are some places that have prioritized this. I do think, and John, you've mentioned this on your show, something that gave me a lot of relief was the CDC saying, if you take some pretty basic steps, you can safely go back to schools without needing to vaccinate everybody, staff and teachers. And that would allow us to prioritize elderly folks and other people who have are at higher risk of getting the virus. So I would say CTU is always is going to use any potential issue where they can make CPS look bad or the mayor look bad, they will seize on. And this is perhaps just another.
Well, I'm militant on this about people who are going to be working with the public, especially close with the public, should get vaccinated and their employers should require it. And I think that's fine. If the CPS requires CTU members to get vaccinated before they come back to work, I think that's good. I think that might be a solution to this problem, is that put those teachers in line right at the head of the line, get them vaccinated, and then actually make them get vaccinated to come back. The policy allows it, government policy allows it. Supreme Court says you can mandate vaccines. I think we should do it. I think it's the way out of this, the fastest way out of this pandemic.
Well, think of all of the intrusions, if you will, that the government does impose on us and that we're used to. Seatbelts. You can't ride the CTA anymore. It's now a federal mandate. They got new signs up there saying you have to wear a mask. You don't let school kids into classrooms without a certain level of vaccination. So I don't think it's an unusual intrusion to say for everybody's good, you got to get a vaccine. And this sounds so heartless, but I'm sorry if for whatever reason you can't do this. I'm not even sure that you should give people a religious exception, but then you can't be a teacher anymore. And that sucks. We really want you to be a teacher. Figure it out. But if you can't do it, we can't let you in.
The law would say, the permissible law would say, well, okay, you can't be a teacher anymore. Maybe if we can accommodate you in some way, maybe make you in charge of some remote learning program, if you have some sort of religious or philosophical objection to vaccines or a medical condition that precludes it. But that just those reasons alone don't mean that, okay, well, we can just waive this and you can come back into the classroom. if you've got a nursing home aide, for instance, who doesn't want to get a vaccine and has a reason that's considered legally valid, then you may or may not be able to fire that person if you can make an accommodation for that person, like give them a job, you know, somewhere in the back room. But if you say that this is the job and you can't do it because you're not vaccinated, that's permissible. And so, yeah, so if you want to teach, you want to be a teacher, you have to get a vaccine. That's not too big an ask to me. Just like, you know, we have our kids get vaccinated before they go to school. They got to have a series of vaccines before they can go to school.
Well,
it's part of being part of a society, part of a healthy society, and part of society protecting each other.
And I'll give them this, Eric, that you get a vaccine doesn't mean that you can't get the coronavirus. It just means that it's not going to make you sick. We're not 100% sure that it doesn't mean you couldn't pass it on to somebody else. So that scenario of I go back to the school, even though I've got the vaccine, I pick up the load of the virus, I bring it home, and I give it to somebody else in my household, that's a possibility. It's so much more remote than it was at the start of this thing, though. But that's a possibility. Other people would say, fine, I'll take that chance. But if you aren't willing to, then we sure can't let you into the classroom. And I don't think that blows up the whole idea of in-person learning. Everybody else is going to go along and you ain't. And it may mean that you don't have a job anymore.
At some point, we balance risk, right? We make teachers travel from their homes to their schools, and there's always a risk that they're going to be struck by a vehicle and killed. I mean, there are always going to be risks involved anytime you get out of your bubble wrap and leave the house. So it's just a matter of balancing that all out.
Yeah.
So, yeah, you could pick, yes, of course, someone who's vaccinated could pick up the virus, could be carried around by someone else who's vaccinated. These possibilities happen. But basically, the idea is that we can't guarantee everybody's safety all the time going forward. But with this kind of mass attack on this situation, we're going to make the day, we're going to hasten the day when this is not really a present fear, when this is a very rare occurrence, that this virus may never completely disappear, but it's going to be very rare. And that's the goal here. That's all we can hope for.
This week, Chris Welch said maybe we ought to revisit the graduated income tax, the fair tax debate in Illinois, but this time earmark the money to go to the pension debt that we have. You guys talked a little bit about this last week, but you didn't mention that per se. How much do you love that idea, Austin Berg?
I think him saying that may have killed off the idea for good. I had a, like 10 reactions to this immediately when this came out. One was all of the cynical people saying this guy's Madigan 2.0 and we're right, you know, out of the frying pan into the fire, another political mastermind. Mike Madigan would never say anything like this out loud to media to allow everyone to just attack him on a policy issue. It was just like politically undisciplined for him to say. The second thing is he's wrong. People aren't going to be super – who just rejected the fair tax by 7 points are going to say, oh, you're going to put it into this huge corrupt pile of debt instead of wherever you said you were going to put it before? Great. Yeah. Like, sounds awesome. I'll sign up this time. The third thing is, like, other states have tried to do that. Colorado tried to pass a progressive tax in 2018, and all the money was going to go to education. All the money was going to go to schools. And Coloradoans have a lot of trust in their state government, and they still rejected it.
Well, as we saw, was it 40 years ago when we started having the lotto?
Yep.
We said, this money's going to go to education. And so, yeah, I think for a time, maybe it all did. They took the money from the lotto and they put it into education. And then they took money that was supposed to be earmarked for education and say, well, we've got lotto money here, so let's take that money and put it over here into the general revenue fund. I mean, money is fungible. Money flows around. So you can say, okay, we're going to take this tax increase. And, you know, I'm in favor of this. I'm in favor of the progressive income tax. But even I can see, like, this is just a non-starter with an electorate that just rejected it for the reasons that Austin talked about. All those reasons are still there because the money will just come in and they'll say, okay, well, we'll take the money from this tax. We'll put it to dependents, and that'll give us more money to spend over here. And you can just imagine the ads. They're just going to rerun all the ads if they are silly, put this back on the ballot. All the ads will just rerun all the ads. And so, I mean, I don't, yes. And I had thought of what Austin said about Madigan would never have said something like, I never would have been as careless as to bring it up.
You guys say careless. I say transparent. I say how refreshing that he's putting
it up. I appreciated the transparency. Finally, someone is saying what's driving tax hikes in Illinois is the pension system.
My first thought was like, ooh, what's the polling show? Does the polling show that if he takes this thing on, that it's sort of this new day that, no, this isn't Madigan talking. This is the new, you know, House Speaker, that somehow this people might go for it under a different House Speaker. I don't know. That it just made me wonder because I was stunned. I thought this is like dead, buried to the center of the earth. I really did not think they would ever resurrect this idea that they were going to have to figure out something new, which, well, I don't know what that would be, but it just seemed to me that there was some kind of political calculus. He's not going to throw something out there unless he thinks he might have a bit of a chance.
Even if they were to pass this, I think if I know my state civics well enough, if they were to try to put this on the ballot again, it would come up in 2022, in the fall of 2022 would be the earliest it could come in front of the voters. That's the last thing J.B. Pritzker wants, if assuming he's running for re-election, would be to be having to divert tens of millions of dollars into yet another fair tax campaign while he's spending his own money again on his reelection campaign. And it's polarizing and it'll tend to bring out more Republican and conservative voters to vote against it.
If this is something that Welch takes on and it's not a Pritzker initiative, maybe he can rise above it.
But what if he was right, Eric? Like, what if that is a good idea? You guys don't trust it for legitimate reasons, but what if diverting income from the high income earners to, I mean, nobody else has got a better idea.
That may be the most frustrating part of this plan. So if Pritzker took all of the money, every dime from that tax hike that he tried to pass and put it into the pension system, mm-hmm. you would, in the most optimistic world possible, using the state's numbers on how the debt grows, which always underestimate how fast it grows, you would cover at most 30% of the pension cost. So how are you selling to people? Yeah, we're going to unlock the Constitution. We're going to make all these tax changes. And by the way, 70% of the pension debt is still going to be there.
What percent?
And 70%. Well, it would cover 30%. So, like, you know, it would cover 3 months of the pension spend.
Okay, but last week you and Neil Steinberg had a statistic that I thought was very interesting the way you put it. You said we are essentially at the state level or city level too, right? A taxing body that happens to pay a pension debt and then also provide some services. What were the numbers on that?
I think I used the example of higher education in Illinois. So in Pritzker's budget, the general fund going to higher education services, educating our future leaders, research, all the amazing stuff that universities do, that entire bucket of money from the general fund is equal to the amount we're paying for pensions of people who used to work in higher education. That's not a service entity. It's a pension system with a social service arm attached. And the last point I'll make on this is Madigan, maybe not the last point, Madigan retired and will benefit from this system. Like, if we're paying more money from a tax hike to go to a pension system, Mike Madigan's getting a $2.9 million pension if he lives to the age of 95 because of a sweetener that he passed. Like, that's the example of the, you know, really important things that this money is going to instead of our social services.
Pritzker and his lieutenant governor, Stratton, threatened that there were going to be dramatic cuts and or hikes in the state income tax rate if the fair tax didn't pass. Fair tax didn't pass, and Pritzker comes back with a budget that has some cuts in it, and there are a few things that obviously we've talked about some of those, but basically it was kind of a status quo budget as far as all that goes. No tax hike and no extremely painful cuts to social services and so on. So people are going to feel like, well, Pritzker's the boy who cried wolf. And so I think that would figure into the campaigning and the messaging on this. Like, yeah, last time they told you the sky was falling, you had to pass the fair tax, and you didn't, and the sky didn't fall. So now you're going to pass it again? I don't understand the politics of it.
We're in an unprecedented pandemic year two, and I'm not sure that they have a lot of options. Raising taxes, you know, a sales tax or anything else, what is that going to do when we're looking at, you know, what did Biden say? Things may start to look like normal again come Christmas. I mean, what are the options here? And the sales tax, you raise that, and then you're hurting lower income people. I don't know what you go for. I don't know what I think. Maybe they should open up like 500 more pot dispensaries is what I think. And then we're all solve the pension crisis, build a new sort of extension on the CTA. And then, of course, my other go-to for money is
ticketing people on Lakeshore Drive.
I swear, the last thing I'll say on the pensions, I think a lot of people, it's tough to talk about because the scale of the problem is not clear. And it's like, well, what? You just keep throwing stuff at it. It just keeps getting worse. A guy at JP Morgan named Michael Sembolist looked at how much more money you'd have to put in the system to make it okay. And it's essentially, you have to slash services to like a Mad Max level Illinois. Or you could hike taxes on everybody by another 50%.
50.
There is nobody on either side of the aisle who is proposing that. And that's why, I mean, we'll have in a couple of weeks out of the Illinois Policy Institute, our Illinois Forward budget plan that'll present a balanced budget without tax hikes. And the key part of it is a constitutional amendment on pensions.
Where you take back some of the money that they were promised, right, Austin? Where you don't give some of the money they were promised.
You don't give some of the increases to what they were promised.
The 3%.
So everything they've already accrued, that's okay, that's protected. Under this constitutional amendment we propose, you can change future benefits.
Before Lisa has to sign off, I want to ask if she's going to handicap for us the battle for Democratic State Party chair. It's Robin Kelly, Alderman Michelle Harris, and Christina Castro, and all these various politicians are lining up behind them. Do you have any idea, Lisa, who's going to take that?
Thanks a lot, Eric. I really don't. I'm looking at an Excel spreadsheet trying to figure out who has the weighted vote here. So I'm nerding out on that to see, you know, how these coalitions, because there's 36 people who have to vote on this. I know that's not what you're asking. I do think it'll probably come down to Congresswoman Robin Kelly. She's from the South Suburbs, and Chicago Alderman Michelle Harris, who's been in the news lately because she is Mayor Lori Lightfoot's floor leader. I mean, she has to sort of help the mayor get her agenda passed in city council. I think it's probably between them. They're getting big backing from, from two senators. One senator, Durbin, has gone with Robin Kelly, and Tammy Duckworth is going with Harris. So that's an interesting weird divide. I'm sort of interested in if there's a bit of a family feud going on there. I don't know, but I don't know.
Yeah, it's curious to me because it seemed like so many of the various politicians. I mean, you've got Durbin lining up behind Kelly. Kelly seems like she would have more reach statewide than a Chicago alderman. And it was curious to me that Tammy Duckworth, and I think the mayor, I know Bobby Rush and some of the other congressmen are behind Alderman Harris.
Bobby Rush is the mayor is steering clear of it. Robin Kelly was a very early supporter of the mayor's campaign. And of course, Michelle Harris is a confidant of the mayor's. That's why she's now the floor leader. So that the mayor said, no, I don't want any part of it.
Is that when the mayor said, you've got to be effing kidding me or something like that? What was her what was her hot mic F-bomb?
Yes. It was something along those lines. And I still don't know the source of that. She was making the comment when Alderman, during a city council meeting yesterday, Wednesday, was reading a resolution about Black History Month and what it means to people of color. And so I would not think that the city's first African-American woman mayor would be even commenting on that. It sounded like she might have been reading something. You know, a lot of times the elected leaders will take care of other business when these resolutions are being read because they can go for hours and hours and hours. And
if you want to read why the mayor should not even be presiding over city council meetings at all, you can read the Tribune piece that I published, I think went up last night, about the city administrator and how she should just maybe stay off of the Zooms in city council.
You had a piece in the paper itself, though, earlier this week about a city administrator or somebody to run the city government, right?
That's the piece, yeah. We also mentioned that weird rule. That city administrator thing is about a rule that is ignored that goes the mayor's favor. And this is another one that's like, nowhere in city code does it say the mayor presides over the council. If the council just gives up that power every 2 years.
You mean there should be a city administrator representing the city at the city council meetings?
No, the administrator would do more stuff like, hey, we don't have a civil unrest plan for the city. Maybe someone should like get on that and coordinate all of this stuff. Yeah. That's what a city administrator would do and why we should have one. Most other cities have like an elected council president.
Well, as I read Austin's column, what one of my takeaways from it was that the job of the city administrator that no longer exists has been taken over by or has been merged into the chief of staff position, which is, as Austin and his co-writer point out, is not the same thing. The chief of staff is a totally different kind of position to the city manager. But that, in terms of, I think it's even in the budget now, right? With the sort of lists those two positions on one line. Is that correct?
Yeah, and the key difference is your chief of staff is just like your right-hand man. It's your buddy. It's the person you put in. A city administrator, as it's laid out, as it was created in 1954 by Martin Kennelly, who was the one reform mayor that they put in right before Daley, said, hey, this is a good idea. What the administrator has to, the difference with the administrator is that the mayor appoints the person, but then they're confirmed by city council. And that's a big check. If Mayor Lightfoot, if someone in city council reads that column and wants to make a big stink about this, that's a huge headache for the mayor because she does not want to have to go through city council to appoint a senior official right now.
By the way, I was going to start this podcast asking you guys if we did brackets for most embarrassing politicians. There goes Lisa. Bye, Lisa. Good job. Bye. Thank you.
Thank you.
For real job.
So if we did brackets for most embarrassing politicians, your one seeds would have to be Texas, Wisconsin, and then Illinois. Since
what about Cuomo?
Oh, yeah. Ron Johnson.
You need an elite eight is what you need.
Well, it's going to be a packed tournament. Let's break it down.
Cuomo's coming in at a one seed with Cruz and
Governor DeSantis down in Florida.
Well, what does Ron Johnson have to gain by still carrying the bucket? I don't see what the point is for carrying the water for Donald Trump on that thing anymore. Trump hasn't even said anything about it lately, although he probably will at that CPAC meeting. But what does he have to gain by that? And he's up in 2022. So does he think that this is going to play in Wisconsin?
John, I think that it does. I think that that's what we're seeing in the primary challenge to Adam Kinzinger. You've got this Catalina Loft, she's 27 years old, woman who ran. She lost to Oberweis in the primary earlier this year. She's now going to shift over and run against Kinzinger, and she is all about Trump. She released a video yesterday talking about how disloyal Kinzinger was, and she's all behind Trump, and the party itself, many people in the party are doubling down on this idea that sticking with Trump, being the party of Trump, is your key to victory. And Johnson has just doubled down on that. When you say, yeah, it's Antifa who is behind the incursion into the Capitol, that's pure Trumpism. I continue to not think that it won't look like a very good gamble in November of 2022, but we'll see.
This woman, Loft, who's running against Adam Kinzinger, I watched that introductory video. I guess that's the one you're talking about. She's lovely. She could be on Fox News. She looks like something straight out of a staff meeting by Donald Trump. I mean, I just thought, oh, my God, here comes another one of these. And Adam Kinzinger, you're going to have to deal with this. And Trump is still in the House. I don't understand it. I don't understand how parroting the things that so many people rejected, especially in Illinois, creates some sort of pathway to victory.
In Kinzinger's district, it went very strongly for Trump. It went even stronger for Kinzinger, but he was the Republican on the ballot there, and he was well-liked, maybe still is. I think if he runs against her, if it's a one-on-one, he may be in some trouble. I think that you may end up seeing four or five arch-conservative candidates, pro-Trump candidates going against Kinzinger, and Kinzinger just slipping through the way it happens in multi-candidate primaries.
Right, right.
I'm not sure it's a bad bet to think that the majority of Republicans in Kinzinger's district are more behind Trump than they are behind him right
now. We talked about this last week. I mean, one of her lines was, is Adam Kinzinger even a Republican anymore? He voted Republican most of 86% of the time. I don't know what it means to be a Republican anymore then.
It's funny. She said that he backed Nancy Pelosi 33% of the time, something like that, in this video. And it could be that there must be a number of issues in which Nancy Pelosi and Trump, everybody, you know, so she may have taken from that a whole bunch of resolutions calling for the wonderfulness of motherhood on Mother's Day and so on. Said, he's voting with Nancy Pelosi. I don't know how you reconcile those figures in his district, but he probably could pull it off.
Is there anything else, Eric?
I did a column on this earlier this week where I think it was really good that the Biden administration allowed U.S. Attorney John Lash to stay in on the job. And the agreement that he reached, I guess, the Biden administration reached with the Senators Duckworth and Durbin, was that this Trump appointee, whom they like, can stay on until his appointment is confirmed. And my argument was, like, Lash is running a whole bunch of different operations or investigations right now. People speak very highly of him across the political spectrum. There's no reason that Biden should replace him at all, that he should just reappoint him. And if somehow that turns into a bad decision, Biden can always give him the sack. There's no problem. He can say, look, you're gone, if he wants to. But it would be such a good bipartisan gesture, a gesture of good faith, a gesture of determination to root out corruption in Illinois, and listening to the local officials. It's a complete win-win for Biden if he does that. I don't know why he hasn't.
I think there's like two or three more indictments yesterday, former state rep and then a high-up CPS official. One thing I was struck by, I totally agreed with Eric's comment, but one thing I would add and was struck by is that there was like a deafening silence on that from some high-up folks in Illinois. The governor offered more praise for Ed Kodat and for Madigan resigning than he did for Lash to keep his job, while Durbin and Tammy Duckworth were great and, you know, vocal about needing to keep him. And I don't know why that was. That seemed like a very poor taste to me, to not support someone who's clearly done such a good job rooting out corruption in your state.
Especially if it looks good. I mean, the optics on it are swell. I think that was part of Eric's point, too.
It was curious, the silence of Pritzker. Lightfoot is a good friend of Lash's, and I think she spoke out. I know she did the other day. She said good things about him. I don't know if that was a little bit late on her part, but I think that she was behind his keeping him on. So.
One last thing. Do you guys have any guesses on what Donald Trump is going to say at CPAC or how that's going to go down? Any surprises? Is it going to be a good speech? Is it going to be more, I won the election?
Won in the landslide.
Actually, I think it was you, Eric, who made the point that he's not a policy guy. I'm not sure that CPAC is the place for that, but I don't see what the purpose of a Donald Trump is there since he lost. And it's not clear that they benefit from having him in the room.
I think CPAC is more like Comic-Con for red meat conservatives than like a place to have a party convention and talk about the platform and stuff. I think it's like, hey, here's all those people you see on TV. You could see them talk, you know, maybe they'll sign your shirt. So I think it's going to rile up the base. One thing that was really funny about CPAC is I think the theme this year was like America Uncanceled or something like that. It was like the tagline. And immediately, like after announcing that, they had to cancel some speaker for horrible remarks that they made. And that's just like totally emblematic of the state of that kind of wing of the Republican Party right now.
What I'm interested in is whether he's going to tip his hand about 2024. Mm-hmm. There's this talk that he's considering it. He might think it's too early to make that kind of a move. It's unlikely to me that he would pull himself out of anything. He will say he's not going to run. But he might say, you know, I'm all in. I'm in it to win it, and here we go. And I think if he did that right now, he would clear the field. Now, of course, it's still a long way off.
He would, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, I don't know what the line is, but I know there is one in Europe about the next election and who the Republican candidate will be. I haven't looked it up. I don't have access to it at this instant, but I'd put money on Trump being a front runner. I'm interested in and then they say, well, then who's his vice president going to be? Talk about getting way ahead of things.
Well, there are a number of prominent Republicans who would be very upset by this. Hawley wants to run, everybody says. Rubio wants to run again. Pence wants to run again.
Nikki Haley is always
Nikki Haley. And so you have all these people, and there might be some movement behind the scenes to begin undercutting him. Because like he did not, you know, he lost them the House, he lost them the Senate, he lost the White House. He's a loser. And they might say, well, let's move on from him. See if we can harness this energy that he has located. Let's move on from him because he is such a uniquely polarized.
He is not a loser, though. He's uniquely polarizing, but he's not a loser. There's nobody
because he won in a landslide. Is what you're saying?
Take three of the people you just mentioned. You can take any three besides Donald Trump. Add their stadium crowds together. It'll be less than one stadium crowd for Donald Trump. Right? You take Nikki Haley and Marco Rubio. pick another one. Take those three rallies. I'll bet I can outsell it with one Donald Trump rally still.
I mean, I think the reason that people were so intrigued by Trump rallies was that you just never knew what crazy-ass thing he was going to say. And that it was compelling theater in that way. I don't know. He wasn't drawing those kind of crowds. Of course, this campaign, it's given the pandemic, it's a little hard to judge what he would have drawn if he'd been going around. But he's kind of like a car accident by the side of the road. You got to stop and see what's going on. And you don't get that from these more careful politicians. Their rallies are more boring. That's the appeal of Trump in terms of, I mean, he got much bigger crowds than Biden got on the road, and he's lost by 7 or 8 million votes.
Well,
if you believe the election people.
Well, Biden didn't try and draw crowds either. I mean, literally, he did not try to draw crowds. He's incapable of it, but at least he had that as a legitimate cover. He wasn't going to go out. But who says that crazy can't still work in 3 years, too? Who knows?
Not me. I thought I knew better when Trump started running, that crazy wasn't going to work.
Yeah. I didn't think he was. I 4 years ago said he wouldn't win the nomination. In fact, I said that I will wash your camper if he does. And then the day he was nominated, I had to spend a full day in a parking lot at an RV park washing campers and trucks and small cars and motorcycles and things like that. Okay. Well, on that happy memory, boys, Austin, thank you for joining us, as always. Eric Zorn from the Chicago Tribune. Lisa Donovan had to exit stage left. Heather Sharon over at Channel 11, WTTW, couldn't join us this week, but I presume will next week. We're produced by Elif Garris. We'll drop another podcast on you next week.
Hey, sorry about the jings. I couldn't figure out how to turn off this. My messages were going off. I finally figured it out.
What mic are you using this week, Eric?
This week, I'm actually in Savannah, Georgia this week.
And, nice.
Using my laptop mic, so.
Taking advantage of the yellow state status for more of these states now?
Yeah, and the 73-degree weather, so it's pretty nice. We thought,
well, it's 40 here, so, yeah. I mean.
I know, we're seeing the weather for second half.
It's a little.
Rocking 41.
Oh, I'm jealous.
Going for a swim. Did you see Mary Schmeek's piece in the Sunday paper interviewing those ladies that go for a swim in the ice every day?
Crazy.
Yeah. Talk to one.
I knew about that one guy who posts the video. There's a group of ladies, though, who do it, too.
Yeah, and they don't just jump in the water. They go for a swim. They bring chisels. They carve out a lane, and they go in. And they're just wearing a one-piece swimsuit. Their legs, arms, and face are exposed.
Did you have one of them on, John?
Yeah, I did. Helen Wagner, the lady who was shown. Just look up the Sunday paper front page. Yeah. The lady's floating on her back. It looks like the Titanic should be nearby. She's just in a bunch of ice floes on her back, lounging in the water like Eric will later. And it's 33 degrees in the water, and it's about 2, and it was 2 degrees above zero at the time. I said, isn't that painful? Like, even if I was going to do it, it must hurt like hell. It hurts like hell to go in the water in July. She says, no. I wonder if people have different, like, temperature sensors in their body or something.
Yeah. Yeah, I wouldn't want to go swimming that early in the morning if I had a heated pool in my house. So the fact that they get in their cars and drive to the lakefront and get out the sledgehammers and the chisels.
Well, she was inspiring in her own way. She was a really lovely lady.
Ahead of Johanna, she's right here. We're done. No, we're done.
Okay. Oh, hi, Johanna. Boy, I haven't seen her in forever. Last I saw her, I was handing you guys she was handing me a cup of coffee. Hi, Johanna.
It's a ghost.
Yeah, it was weird. Oh, boy, the warm weather suits you guys well. You look good.
I know. I'm more relaxed already. It's weird how you just don't notice how the weather just affects you.
Subscribe to the Mincing Rascals podcast on iTunes or the Google Play Music Store. You can now also follow us on Spotify, or you can keep listening online at WGNRadio.com.